Alec called Magnus's cell phone and waited again. There was still no answer. This time his stomach took a small, cold tumble. Was Magnus all right?
"This is very awkward," said Aline.
Helen was looking sorry for Alec. He glared at her.
"Look," she said, "we have something. We know about a meeting point near Rome that the Crimson Hand used. Why don't we go there together? And then we'll see what we see."
It was clear she thought they would find Magnus there, evilly leading an evil cult.
"Fine," said Alec, putting his phone away. "I want to find the Crimson Hand more than you do. I have to clear Magnus of these allegations. I'll allow you to help me with my investigation."
"Your investigation," Helen repeated. "This is my investigation, and I thought you were on vacation."
"He can be both investigating and on vacation," Aline said defensively.
She and Helen both started talking over each other in low, intense voices, beginning their second argument in the 3 minutes since they'd met. Alec really hoped he hadn't gotten Aline into trouble. He looked away from the argument and met Leon's eyes.
"I don't think you have anything to do with this cult business," Leon told him.
"Oh," Alec said. "Thanks, Leon."
"I hope Alan's zeal won't get in the way of you and me crawling closer."
"Huh?" said Alec.
Leon appeared to take this as encouragement. Alec did not see why he would. Leon came closer. Alec edged back toward Aline.
"Alan and I have a lot in common," Leon said.
"Good for you."
"One of the things we have in common," Leon ventured, "is that we are both interested in a variety of company. If you follow me."
"I don't," said Alec. Leon glanced around, then said rapidly,
"I mean we are both bisexual, interested in men and women."
"Oh," said Alec. "I don't know a lot about that, but again, good for you." Alec knew Magnus was the same way. He had begun to learn that there was a whole world he had been entirely cut off from. Words like bisexual and pansexual, he'd never really known. It made him grimly sad to think now of his younger self, how desperately lonely he'd been, how he'd been sure he was the only one who'd ever had the feelings he did. In the dark, small corners of his soul, Alec worried sometimes. Why would Magnus choose him if he could choose a girl, a woman, an easier life? He thought of how terrified he'd been once of how he would be judged. But then, if Magnus wanted an easier life, surely he wouldn't have chosen a shadow hunter at all.
"When this is over, I could come to New York," Leon suggested. "You could show me a good time."
He winked.
"Please tell me you're getting the implications this time," Leon added.
"I am," said Alec.
"Fantastic," Leon told him. "We'll have to keep it quiet, but I think we could have fun. You have so much going for you, Alec. You can do better than some downworlder with a shady past. Hey, do you have any time tonight?"
Leon was handsome, Alec guessed. If Leon had come to New York when Alec was angry and miserable and thought nothing was ever going to happen for him, Alec might have taken him up on his offer.
"No," he said. He turned away, then looked over his shoulder.
"I want to be clear," he added. "No, I have plans for tonight that don't include you. No, I'm not interested in fun on the quiet. And no, I can't do better than Magnus. There isn't better than Magnus." Leon raised his eyebrows as Alec's voice rose. Aline and Helen took notice and looked up from their quiet, intense argument.
"Leon, are you making a pass?" demanded Helen Blackthorne. "Why do you always do this? Stop hitting on people, Leon."
"My life is short and I am handsome and French," Leon muttered.
"Okay, we're going to this Crimson Hand meeting place. You're out. Aline's in," said Helen. "Don't seduce anyone until we get back." She turned to Alec. "Let's go get some weapons and do this. Try to keep up."
She strode away, and Aline moved to walk alongside Alec, a few steps behind.
"So, have you known Helen Blackthorne long?"
she asked gruffly and coughed.
You said she was kissing a vampire girl at that party? Didn't you say that?
Alec had a vision of Helen, pale arms around a vampire girl in the moonlight. He shouldn't have mentioned it to Aline. It was Helen's business, and it would be his fault if Aline thought of Helen differently now. He hardly knew Helen, but he felt a hot rush of protectiveness. It was as if he heard someone whispering about him when he was younger and even more scared.
I haven't known Helen long, he answered. I guess Jace told you about that time we kissed?
Aline continued irrelevantly.
Like, why we kissed? He was helping me figure something out.
Alec looked at Aline sadly. Aline had always seemed very level-headed about boys, but Jace was the exception to many rules.
My Pirabatai doesn't kiss and tell, he said in a gentler tone.
Oh, Aline returned her voice flat. Alec had spent so long with a desperate, impossible crush on Jace. He had thought it was a secret. Now he knew everyone had always known, especially Jace. Jace had never minded. He had understood Alec needed to have a crush on someone who was safe. On a boy who, if Alec said, I like you to him, would not have punched Alec in the face or dragged him in front of the clave. People could be horrendously, violently awful about anyone who was different. That crush was a memory now. It had seemed part of his overall love for Jace once, the love that made them Pirabatai, but now it seemed more like the passing touch of light on metal. The gleam was gone, but the gold of friendship remained, pure and true. There were worse people to have a crush on than Jace Herondale. He would never be cruel to Aline about it. But he loved Clary, in a way that had stunned Alec, who had never imagined Jace in love like that. And that wasn't going to change.
Be nice to Helen Blackthorne, Alec said urgently. You don't have to like her, but don't treat her differently from any other shadow hunter.
Aline blinked.
I wasn't planning on it. Of course, she's a colleague. I will treat her in a professional fashion. That was my plan for how to treat her. With a calm professionalism.
Good, said Alec.
Do you have her phone number?
Aline asked.
In case we get separated or something?
I don't, said Alec. In the weapons room, Helen came toward them, her arms full of seraph blades, her fair hair curling around her ears. Aline made a sighing sound.
We were going to check out demonic activity, said Alec to Aline, in the records room. We never did that.
Aline began taking seraph blades out of Helen's arms and stowing them on her person.
Wouldn't you rather take action than look up records? If this is a dead end, we can always look at the records later.
Through the wide windows set over Rome, Alec could see the sun begin its descent. The city was still gold, but the very tops of the buildings were now crowned with red.
That makes sense, he said.
He took a couple of seraph blades for himself. Helen grinned an eager grin.
Let's go hunting.
Chapter 20. Aqua Morte.
Magnus was alone for 10 minutes, during which he lolled around and thought of Alec. Then there came a knock on the door. Magnus brightened.
Come in.
He was severely disappointed. It was not Alec deciding he should stay after all. It was Xin Yun.
I've been in touch with the contact, she said without preamble. I'm meeting her at the Downworld bathhouse soon.
She stopped and looked around with a surprised air.
Where's Alec?
He's gone to find out whatever he can at the Rome Institute.
Magnus decided no further explanation was necessary.
Ah, yes. Well, if you're bored here alone, you could always come with me to my appointment in the Roman baths, said Xin Yun. My contact won't talk in front of you, but if she has information and you're nearby, we could act on it immediately. Your presence in a place like that wouldn't be questioned. Arx would be.
Magnus considered her offer. On the one hand, he told Alec he would stay here. On the other, acting on information immediately might get them closer to being done with this whole sorry business. Magnus took a moment to imagine resolving the cult situation on his own, being able to go to Alec and tell him that it was all over, that Alec could relax.
I do love Roman baths, Magnus said. Why not?
They walked toward the Acqua Morte bathhouse in the historic center of Rome, along the golden waters of the Tiber. Magnus had forgotten how much more gold Rome was than any other city, like treasure brought home from a conquest.
Go back to where you came from, muttered a man in Italian, glancing from Magnus's Indonesian to Xin Yun's Korean face.
He moved to shove past them, but Xin Yun held up a hand. The man froze.
I've always wondered what that saying is about, Magnus said casually.
I wasn't born in Italy, but many people are, who don't fit your idea of what people born here look like.
Is it that you think their parents weren't from here? Or their grandparents?
Why do people say it?
Is the idea that everyone should go back to the very first place their ancestors came from?
Xin Yun stepped up to the man, who remained fixed in place, his eyeballs twitching.
Wouldn't that mean, Magnus asked, that ultimately we all have to go back to the water?
Xin Yun flicked a finger, and the man was flung with a brief squeak into the Tiber. Magnus made sure he fell without injury and drifted him to the riverside. The man climbed out and sat down on the bank with a squelch. Magnus hoped he would think about his choices.
I was only going to make him think I would drop him in the water, Magnus clarified. I understand the impulse, but just making him afraid of us.
He trailed off and sighed.
Fear isn't a very efficient motivator.
Fear is all some people understand, Xin Yun said.
They were standing close together. Magnus could feel the tension running through Xin Yun's body. He took her hand and gave it a brief, friendly squeeze before he dropped it. He felt a faint pressure of her fingers in return, as if she'd wanted to squeeze back.
I did this to her, he thought, as he always did. The five small words that circled in his mind repeatedly when he was around Xin Yun.
I prefer to believe that people can understand a lot when offered the opportunity, said Magnus.
I like your enthusiasm, but let's not drown anyone.
Spoil spot, said Xin Yun, but her tone was friendly.
They parted ways once they reached the bathhouse, Xin Yun to find her contact and Magnus to find a bath. The Acqua Morte was a vampire-run bathhouse which seemed a peculiar marriage to Magnus. It was four giant heated mineral baths, each the size of an Olympic swimming pool, and several smaller rooms filled with single tubs. Magnus paid for time in one of these smaller rooms and went to change. The vampire clan who ran this establishment were a contrary lot. They had also used the bathhouse as a controlled feeding zone for centuries, until the Nephilim put a stop to it. Magnus considered that so far, this was not such a demanding assignment. He went into his assigned room, let the towel slide down from his waist, and stepped into the sunken tub. Steam drifted up in the near-scalding water. It was just barely tolerable, the way Magnus liked it. He sank into the tub until only his head was above water, letting his body acclimate to the burn, feeling the waves of pain and pleasure shoot up and down his body. He perched his arms over the sides and leaned back. The ancient Romans had known how to live. He had a few bruises and scrapes left over from the night on the train, and the night the mansion collapsed on them. By now, they were faint and ached only if he moved in a particular way. He could have healed himself any time, but chose to let time heal the wounds. Not because he enjoyed the pain, far from it. When he had first learned to heal himself, he'd spent copious amounts of time and magic doing away with every single little hurt. Over the centuries, though, he'd learned that these minor injuries were part of life. Suffering through them made him appreciate being whole and well. Right now was a perfect example. Magnus could feel each individual ache and cut throb in the hot bathwater and dissipate with the steam. He closed his eyes and relaxed. Magnus had paid for a private room, but after a time he felt a presence hovering nearby. Before he could say anything, someone rudely invaded his tub, disturbing the flat surface and sending ripples of mineral water sloshing over the side. Several sharp words came to mind, and he opened his eyes, ready to deliver them. Instead, he was surprised to see Xin Yun sitting on the edge of the tub, wrapped in a towel. She was leaning against the wall beside her, resting her face on an elbow.
Oh, he said. Hello.
I hope you don't mind the intrusion.
I do, actually, but it's all right.
Magnus passed a hand over the water's surface, and a towel materialized around his waist. He didn't think Qinyun was making a pass, and he didn't personally have a problem with nudity, but it was an odd situation. Qinyun carefully moved Magnus's phone, which he had set on the side of the tub, out of the way as she reached for a hand towel. She wiped her face, which she did not actually need to do. She was clearly buying herself time.
Did you get anything? Magnus asked. From your contact, I mean.
I did, said Qinyun slowly. But first, I have a confession to make. I overheard your conversation the other night about how you killed your stepfather.
Magnus had been speaking in a low voice.
So you eavesdropped?
Magically eavesdropped, he added.
I was curious, said Qinyun with a shrug, as if this excused her. And you're famous, and you work closely with the Nephilim. I thought you had no problems, that you lived a life of careless luxury. I didn't think you were like me.
She bowed her head. In this moment, there was an earnestness to her that Magnus hadn't seen before. She seemed more vulnerable, more open, and it had nothing to do with the fact that they were both sitting mostly naked in a hot tub. She looked up at him.
Do you need a drink?
He didn't, particularly, but he sensed she might want one.
Sure.
A silver platter appeared a few seconds later with a bottle of Barbera d'Asti and a couple of large balloon glasses. Qinyun poured for each of them and floated Magnus's glass over to him. They touched glasses. She was struggling with her words.
I know your story now. It is only fair you know mine. I was lying to you before.
Yes, Magnus said. I thought you might be.
Qinyun drained her glass in one gulp and set it aside.
When my demon mark manifested, my betrothed did not love me despite everything. My family rejected me, the whole village rejected me, and so did he. Men came with shovels and torches and cries for my life, and the person I always thought was my father handed me over to the mob. My beloved was the one who placed me in the wooden box to be buried alive.
Qinyun slid down in the tub until she was nearly horizontal, and only her face, still as a death mask, broke the water's plane.
She looked up at the marble ceiling. I can still hear the dirt falling on the coffin, like the heavy drumming of rain on rooftops during a typhoon.
She curled her fingers beneath the surface of the water.
I crawled until my hands were raw.
Magnus could hear the scratching sounds of fingernails on wood as Qinyun wove magic around her tail. He could feel the walls closing in on him and the shortness of breath in his lungs. He took a gulp of wine to soothe his throat and set the glass aside.
Seek the children of demons. Love them as you love your Lord. Do not let the children be alone. They dug me up. Together, we slaughtered every soul in my village. We killed them all. I did worse, Rita. At the Crimson Hand's behest, they told me to trust them. I was so grateful. I wanted to be wrong. I'm sorry, Magnus whispered. Qinyun is me. She is my dark mirror.
I know, Qinyun said. The Crimson Hand always spoke of you, their lord who would return. They said we should make you proud when the time came. I used to wrong for you to come back. I wanted you to be my family.
I would have been, said Magnus. But I didn't remember the cult. I didn't know anything about you. If I'd known, I would have come.
I believe you, said Qinyun. I trust you. My whole life, I was taught to trust you.
Magnus picked his glass up. I promise, I will do whatever it takes to help you, and to put an end to this.
Thank you,
she said simply. They settled back into the tub. I met with my informant, Xinyan said, her voice returning to its usual businesslike demeanor. She suggested a meeting place in Rome where the Crimson Hand are meant to assemble. She said their leader had been seen there recently. Did she say if it was Barnabas Hale?
She didn't know his name, said Xinyan. This is all second hand. Nobody from the court will talk, not after what happened to Mori Shu.
We should tell Alec, said Magnus.
We can send him a text message, Xinyan said, but not from within the bath. There's no reception here. I didn't want to tell him before I told you and...
You and I were able to have a word in private. Magnus was briefly annoyed, but it seemed petty to quibble when Xinyan had just told him about being buried alive. No time like the present, he said. He stood and waved a hand, and his wet towel transformed itself into jeans and a dark blue shirt scattered with yellow stars. He retrieved his phone and frowned at it. The screen seemed to be frozen. Xinyan cast her own spell, and her towel began to snake all over her body, drying her off. When it was finished, it dropped to the floor. She was already dressed underneath, wearing the same black armored business suit she'd worn in Venice. She patted her waist and thigh, checking for two knives that disappeared as quickly as she pulled them out. Satisfied, she motioned to the door.
After you.
Magnus turned his phone off, rebooting it. What a time for it to break down. Still, there were plenty of ways to get a message to Alec. Soon they would be together again. Soon they would find and stop the leader of the Crimson Hand. Soon they could be done with all of this. Chapter 21, Fire in the Crimson Hand. Magnus was late. Before they had gotten a block away from the Rome Institute, Alec received a curt message from Xinyan telling him that Magnus's phone wasn't working. She had gotten a tip from one of her local contacts, and she and Magnus were headed to a specific location in a forest somewhat outside the city. She didn't explain why Magnus was with her or where they had been. When Alec shared the information with Helen and Aline, they all agreed it made sense to meet up with Magnus and Xinyan at this rendezvous. It was more current information than what Mori Shu had given Helen, and even if it turned out to be a dead end, at least they'd all be in one place. As time ticked by, Alec wondered whether Xinyan and Magnus had somehow gotten lost, or he'd misunderstood the direction. He'd been sure they would arrive by now, or that he would have heard from Magnus if there was a problem. He felt thrown off balance by having heard from Xinyan on Magnus's behalf. He checked the time again and looked to see the sun lost behind the trees. Evening was rushing upon them like an enemy, and there was only so much witchlight could do in a thick forest. He eyed the line of trees. He couldn't see farther than a few feet. The forest felt haunted. Giant gnarled branches huddled close together, some intertwining like lovers, making it difficult to stray far past the narrow dirt path. Blossoming canopies masked the sky. Shadows of leaves danced with the wind.
Can't cultists get a room? Aline grumbled. Like in town?
It had rained earlier, so the ground was a wet, slippery slush, making traversing the terrain difficult and messy. Aline in particular was struggling, having worn shoes more suited to sitting at a cafe than tracking evildoers.
Here, try this.
Helen took out a knife and sliced two long pieces of bark off the nearest tree. She got down on one knee in front of Aline and cupped her heel. Aline froze in place as Helen gently raised Aline's leg and tied the bark to the bottom of her foot. She repeated the operation on the other foot.
There. Now you'll have better traction.
Aline's eyes were very wide. Alec noted disapprovingly that she did not even say thank you. Helen took the lead, and Alec lengthened his stride to keep up with her. His sneakers were sliding in the mud too, but nobody had offered him bark shoes. Helen's footstep was lighter than his or Aline's. She did not move exactly like a fairy, Alec had seen them walk without crushing a blade of grass, yet she wasn't sliding in the mud like they were either. Under the movements of a warrior was the shadow of fairy grace.
"The bark shoes aren't a fairy trick, if that's what you two are thinking," Helen snapped at Alec as he drew level with her. "I learned it from shadow hunters in Brazil."
Alec blinked.
"Why would we be thinking that? Look, I'm sorry if Aline is being weird. It's my fault. I told her about what happened on the night of the party in Venice. I mean, how I first saw you with the Downworlder girl."
Helen snorted.
"Don't you mean the other Downworlder girl?"
"No," said Alec. "You're a shadow hunter."
"I'm really sorry. I was worried about Magnus, and I'm bad at lying. There was a time I would have hated if anyone told a stranger about me."
"Don't worry about it," said Helen. "It's not a secret that I like girls as well as boys."
"Too bad if it bothers Aline."
She sneaked a look at Aline over her shoulder, then shrugged.
"Pity. That girl is hot like hellfire."
Alec ducked his head and smiled. He was a bit surprised, but it was nice to talk to Helen about this, to see how calm and fearless she was.
"Probably," he said. "I wouldn't know."
He added shyly, "I think my boyfriend's pretty hot, though."
"Sure, I saw him," said Helen.
"I see why you lost your head. I just don't trust him."
"Because he's a Downworlder?"
Alec's voice was hard.
"Because I have to be more objective when assessing Downworlders than anyone else does," said Helen.
Alec looked over at her, the curve of her ears and the faint luminous sheen to her skin beneath her Shadow Hunter runes. Against the backdrop of a forest, Helen looked even more like a fairy.
"You're sure you're being objective?"
"I think Magnus Bane founded this cult," said Helen, "which makes him the obvious suspect for their leader. From everything people say, this leader is a powerful warlock. There are maybe a dozen warlocks in the world who fit the bill. How many of them were at the party?"
"Malcolm Bade," said Alec.
Helen stepped.
"It wasn't Malcolm."
"It wasn't the warlock you trust," said Alec.
"I see.
How about Barnabas Hale?"
Helen came to a halt right there in the sliding mud and gathering dark.
"He was there?" she asked. "He wasn't on the guest list."
"He crashed the party," said Alec. "So hard, the mansion fell down."
"I knew Malcolm fought with another warlock," Helen murmured. "I was so busy trying to get people out, I didn't see the fight. I figured it must have been Magnus Bane."
So there was another reason Helen was so down on Magnus. She'd wanted to protect Malcolm, her own local high warlock.
"It wasn't Magnus," said Alec. "He got in the middle to stop the fight. He tried to get people out, just like you did."
Helen took a moment to absorb this. Alec was glad to see she didn't know everything, and even more glad she seemed to be willing to consider taking this new idea to heart. Maybe, with Helen and Aline to help him, they could inquire discreetly about Barnabas among the Shadow Hunters.
"I don't know any of those warlocks," Aline announced, "but I think this might be the meeting place."
She pointed at a small clearing a few steps away from the path. It did not take a shadow hunter to tell that the area was being used for occult activity. The burned-in pentagram in the dirt at their feet was a dead giveaway, but there was more. There was a makeshift altar with two fire pits on either side and several slashes on the trees nearby that were reminiscent of claw marks. There was also a deep circular indentation pressed into the dirt. Helen walked to the edge of the clearing and checked in the bushes. She pulled out a beer keg and rolled it across the grass.
"Whoa," said Aline. "The evil cultists like to party?"
"Partying hard is one of their sacred rules," said Alec.
Helen gave him a puzzled look and he explained,
"The Red Scrolls of Magic. It's their sacred text. I'll loan you my copy."
He passed the phone, with the pictures Isabel had sent, over to Aline, who then passed it to Helen without Alec's permission. Helen frowned.
"The last commandment is not to let children be alone," she said. "That sounds strangely nice. For a cult?"
"It is nice, isn't it?"
Alec asked blandly. Everything about Magnus was strange but nice. Alec did not say this, since Helen would take it as a confession.
"Morty's shoe was murdered by vampires," Helen Blackthorne said sharply. "Neither Malcolm
nor Barnabas Hale, nor Hypatia Vex, the only other warlocks in the vicinity I know of with anything like enough power, have any particular affiliation with vampires, whereas Magnus Bane is well known to have strong ties and even romantic entanglements with some of the worst vampires of the New York clan, several of whom were at the party where Mori Shu and I were supposed to meet up, the party where Mori Shu was killed, before he could tell anyone what he knew. Alex scoffed silently at the idea of Magnus having romantic entanglements with vampires, especially criminal ones. He had seemed to regard Lily and Elliot and the others as amusing children. Although it was true, he knew very little about Magnus's love life. Magnus had opened up a great deal about his past on this trip, but not that part. He pushed the thought away. Raphael and Lily didn't murder anyone at that party. Who are they? Helen demanded. Are they vampires? Raphael Santiago is definitely a vampire, said Aline, when Alec hesitated. Close with them too, are you? No, said Alec. Helen and Aline were surveying him with identical expressions of worry. Alec did not need them to tell him how bad this all looked. It looked bad. Magnus was still nowhere in sight. The forest was a maze, and the light was dying. He swept his gaze across the trees. It wouldn't be long before they were veiled in darkness. Night was when demons came out, and when shadow hunters did their work. Alec would not have minded the dark, except that he wanted Magnus to find them. Something else nagged at him. A worry under an ocean of worries. It was like taking a blow across the face and feeling, under the wash of pain, the consciousness of a loose tooth. Helen, said Alec, what did you say the last commandment in the Red Scrolls of Magic was? To look after the children, Helen answered, sounding puzzled. Excuse me, said Alec. He retrieved his phone and walked across the pentagram to the other side of the clearing. He had already tried calling Magnus multiple times. He intended to try someone else. The phone rang twice and was picked up. Hello? Alec said. Raphael?
They're not close, Helen muttered, except he calls him to chat.
I know, said Aline. Alec seems so guilty. I swear he's not, but everything he's doing looks really bad.
Lose this number,
Raphael's voice snapped on the other end of the line. Alec looked around the shadowy clearing at Helen and Aline, who were both shaking their heads sadly in his direction. He was apparently not impressing anybody tonight. I know you're not crazy about shadow hunters, Alec said, but you did say I could call. There was a pause.
That's just how I answer all phone calls, Raphael claimed. What do you want?
I thought this was about what you wanted. I thought you wanted to help, said Alec. You said you'd look into the Crimson Hand. I wondered if you'd learned anything, specifically about Mori Shu. The remains of both fires near the pentagram were still warm, and the candles had last been used only a few hours ago. He knelt next to one of the lines of the pentagram and sniffed the residue, blackened earth with charcoal and salt, but no blood.
No, said Raphael.
Right, said Alec. Thanks anyway.
Wait,
Raphael snapped.
Hang on a minute.
There was another pause. It went on for a very long time. Alec heard the sound of footsteps on stone, and from far away, the silvery but somehow unpleasant sound of a woman's voice. Raphael, said Alec, some of us are not immortal, so we can't stay on the phone forever. Raphael growled in frustration, which was a significantly more alarming sound coming from a vampire. Alec held the phone slightly away from his ear and drew it back when he heard Raphael forming actual words.
There is one thing,
said Raphael, and hesitated again.
Yes?
The silence between Raphael's words was so empty. Raphael was not breathing in them. Vampires didn't have to.
You're not going to believe me. This is pointless.
Try me, said Alec.
Mori Shu wasn't killed by a vampire.
Why didn't you say anything?
Who was I going to tell?
Raphael snarled.
Just trot up to a Nephilim and say, oh, please, sir, the vampires were framed. Yes, a body was found, and yes, it was missing blood, but not anything like enough blood. And yes, there were marks on the neck.
but they were marks made by the point of his sword and not fangs, and, oh no, Mr. Nephilim, please put the Seraph blade away.
No Nephilim would believe me.
I believe you, Alec said. Were they made with a three-sided sword? Like a Samgakdo? There was a pause.
Yes,
Raphael said.
They were.
Alec's stomach tightened. Thanks, Raphael. You've been a lot of help.
Have I?
Raphael's voice was suddenly even more wary.
How?
I'll tell Magnus.
Don't you dare,
said Raphael.
Don't call me anymore. I have no interest in helping you ever again. Don't tell anyone about me helping you this time.
Gotta go.
Stop,
Raphael commanded.
Do not hang up.
Alec hung up. Raphael immediately tried to call him back. Alec turned his phone off. What's happening? Aline asked. Why do you look like that? Helen, said Alec, you mentioned Hypatia Bex as a possible suspect. So Mori Shu never specifically said the leader of the Hand was a man? Helen blinked. He didn't say anything that would indicate either way.
People at the Paris Shadow Market spoke as if it was a man, Alec said in a low voice, because the rumor was that it was Magnus. Even if someone didn't believe it was Magnus, they said he, without thinking. And Magnus and I were so busy defending him, we didn't think.
The informant on the Crimson Hand murdered at the party in Venice, marked with the point of a three-sided blade. In times of trouble, remember, all roads lead to Rome. The line was missing from the version of the Red Scrolls of Magic Isabel had sent him. The one in the chamber had been altered to add an extra rule, pointing them toward Rome. And Xin Yang Zheng, a warlock who was clearly a well-trained warrior, whose movements were usually quick and graceful, had tripped and made sure they found the altered book, leading them here.
We have to go, said Alec, now.
Just as he turned back in the direction they had come, the woods around them came alive. A sharp wind rustled the branches and tumbled the leaves. The air around them warmed, the temperature spiking alarmingly. It had been a cool, breezy night a few seconds ago, but now they were in sweltering heat. Five pillars of fire rose at the edge of the clearing around them, each several stories tall and as thick as a tree trunk. Branches and rocks snapped, flames licked the vegetation and consumed it, and the air became thick and nearly impossible to breathe. The pillars crackled and ejected large embers into the sky, hundreds of fireflies swirling in the air. All three shadow hunters took out their steelies and rapidly drew some marks for defense, accuracy, stamina, strength, and maybe most important, fireproof. Putting away her steely, Aline whispered, Jophiel! And her angel-infused daggers appeared in her hands. Alec took out his bow, and a glowing white light illuminated Helen's hand as she drew her seraph blade and named an angel as well. Alec couldn't hear the name over the roar of the flames. At the risk of sounding redundant, said Helen, oh no, this is a trap. They gathered, standing back to back to back in the middle of the clearing. In light of what they were facing, it seemed very inadequate.
This was stupid coming here with only three of us, said Alec. The Crimson Hand knew exactly where we would be and when.
How?
Aline demanded.
Alec knocked an arrow on his bowstring. Because their leader. She told us to be here.
Chapter 22. The Great Poison. The ancient villa towered before Magnus, its broken towers like jagged teeth rising into the sky. Subtle these cultists are not, Magnus commented. He checked his watch.
Alec should be here by now.
Xin Yun was standing beside him. He could feel the tension running through her entire body.
Maybe they're questioning him at the Rome Institute, she said. You know the Nephilim will not look favorably on anything he has been doing. He could be in a lot of trouble, and if we wait for him any longer, we'll lose our chance to capture the Crimson Hand.
According to Xin Yun's informant, senior members of the Crimson Hand were meeting with a group of potential disciples. Their leader might even be present. Alec would want Magnus to wait for him. Magnus wanted to wait for Alec, but Xin Yun was right. Alec could be trapped, answering difficult questions at the Rome Institute, and it would be all Magnus's fault. The best thing Magnus could do would be to capture the leader and put an end to the Crimson Hand. Surely the Nephilim would be appeased, and Alec cleared of any suspicion. Shinyun said,
"This could be our only opportunity."
Magnus took a deep breath and decided his hesitation was absurd. This was nothing he could not handle on his own. He had always done just fine by himself before. "Lead the way," he told Shinyun. They entered the villa through what had evidently once been a stable and searched their way through a series of rooms. The building had long since been ransacked. Broken cabinets, torn tapestries, shattered glass littered the floors. Nature had already begun the slow process of consuming the villa. Weeds and vines infiltrated the cracks in the walls and windows. The strong scent of stagnant water lingered in the air. Everything was damp. The dank smell was making Magnus lightheaded. He was finding it a little difficult to breathe. "Evil can be excused sometimes. Squalor, though, never," Magnus murmured. Shinyun murmured back,
"Will you stop making jokes?"
"Unlikely," said Magnus. They entered a long room with a low ceiling and broken shelves. In another life, it had probably served as a pantry. Now, rotting wood, cracked stone, and overgrown vines spiderwebbed the walls. A pool of water rested where the ground had sunk in. Shinyun held up a finger and froze. Magnus listened. There it was, a noise at last. The faint sound of chanting. Shinyun pointed to the other end of the room and crept across, giving the dirty pool of water a wide berth. Just as she was about to leave the room, a metal portcullis, apparently in much better repair than the rest of the place, slammed down in the doorway in front of her. Magnus moved toward the doorway behind them, from where they had entered, but it was too late. There was the sound of rolling metal, and another gate crashed down before he could reach it. Magnus grasped the gate and pulled. It wouldn't budge. They were trapped. Shinyun tried the first gate again. Magnus crossed the room and joined her. It was no use. It was far too heavy. He stepped back and mustered his magic, meaning to shatter the iron gate to dust. His hand glowed dark blue, and a streak of energy left his fingertips, but it died before it reached the gate. He felt unexpectedly weak, as if he had just performed a huge spell instead of something very standard. He blinked away the dimness in his vision.
"Something wrong?" Shinyun asked.
Magnus waved his hand carelessly. "Nothing at all." Shinyun grabbed a large rock from the ground and began to hammer at the rustiest parts of the gate. Magnus retreated to the center of the room.
"What are you doing?"
Shinyun asked. A green funnel rose up around him, whipping his coat and making his hair stand sideways. He called up every drop of magic he could to help the funnel gain steam, right up to the point that the spell began to fracture. With a final cry, Magnus channeled everything he had into this howling tornado and focused it on the doorway from which they had entered. The iron screeched and groaned, and then the gate tore free of the stone and flew down the hallway. It disappeared into the darkness before clanging into stone off in the distance. Magnus fell to one knee, gasping. There was something very wrong with his magic.
"How could you do that?" Shinyun asked softly. "How did you get to be so strong? Surely now you have no power left."
Magnus forced himself to stand and began to stagger toward the blasted open exit.
"I'm leaving."
Just as he was about to pass Shinyun, she threw an arm out and grabbed him by the front of the shirt.
"I don't think so."
Magnus studied her still face in the shadowed light. His heartbeat rang in his own ears, signaling danger far too late.
"I see that my beautiful, trusting nature has been imposed on," he said. "Again."
Shinyun spun, using Magnus's own weight as momentum to throw him, sending him tumbling halfway across the room. He tried to get back on his feet, but was thrown back by a kick to the chest. He fell again, slamming into the remaining gate. Then he heard the sound of metal on metal and the grind of the portcullis lifting upward, and he felt several pairs of strong hands closing on his arms.
he was almost unable to see. I was exposed to a potion that made me lose control of my shape-shifting abilities, Tessa had told him. Magnus should have remembered.
You put poison in my drink at the Aquamorte, he said, struggling to form the words. You distracted me with a sob story.
Was it all a lie? Xinyan knelt down beside him on the wet stone. He could only make out the outlines of her face like a mask hanging in the dark.
No, she whispered. I huddle to make you feel sorry enough for me. I huddle to tell you the truth. That's one more thing I can never forgive you for.
Magnus wasn't that surprised to wake up in prison. A trickle from the ceiling had found its way to his forehead, bouncing drops off it every few seconds, which reminded him of how the Silent Brothers used to discipline him to get him to stop talking during his studies. Some of the water dribbled into his mouth, and he spat it out. He hoped it was only water. Whatever it was tasted foul. He blinked, trying to acclimate to his surroundings. He was enclosed by a curved, windowless wall with an iron gate leading out to more darkness and a hole on the far side that was either an old escape route or a latrine. Judging by the smell in the air, Magnus thought maybe it had been both. It's official, he declared to no one in particular. This is the worst vacation ever. He looked up. There wasn't much moonlight, but what there was created a faint glow through a circular grate. This place looked like the bottom of a cistern, maybe. Or a well, not that it made any difference. A hole, a cell, the bottom of a well. It was still prison. His hands were chained to the wall over his head, and he was sitting on a bed of hay that looked like it had already passed through the horse. The floor beneath him was cut stone, so he was probably still on the grounds of the villa somewhere. Magnus swallowed. His face and neck hurt a lot. He could really use a drink. He hoped Alec truly was stuck at the Rome Institute, that he hadn't gone where Xinyan had told him to go, which he now realized was clearly not this place. At the Institute, Alec would be safe. A silhouette appeared on the other side of the gate. Metal clanged, and a hinge squealed as the gate swung open.
Don't worry, said Xinyan. The poison won't kill you.
Because I will, intoned Magnus. Xinyan blinked at him. Oh, that was where you were going with that, wasn't it? He asked. He closed his eyes. He had the worst headache.
I measured the poison very carefully, said Xinyan. Just enough to put you out and obliterate your magic. I want you on your feet when you fulfill your ever so glorious destiny.
That didn't sound good. When Magnus opened his eyes, she was standing in front of him. She was dressed all in snowy white with silver embroidery at her collar and cuffs.
My glorious destiny? Magnus asked. It's always a glorious destiny. Have you noticed that? Nobody ever references the mediocre destinies.
Xinyan said,
No, mine is the destiny that will be glorious. You do not deserve glory. You started this cult as a joke. You had people pull pranks and heal the sick. You made a mockery of the name of Asmodeus.
Mockery is the best use I've found for his name, Magnus murmured. Xinyan's voice was furious.
We should have both happy been loyal to Asmodeus. He favored you so greatly, you are not worthy of him.
He's not worthy of me, Magnus remarked. Xinyan shouted over him,
I'm tired of your endless mockery and disrespect. We owe Asmodeus life. I will never be like you. I will never betray my father.
Your father? Echoed Magnus. Xinyan paid him no attention.
I had been buried alive for 5 days when the Crimson Hunt rescued me. They told me Asmodeus had sent them to rescue his daughter. My father's people saved me because my father is always watching me.
My mortal family betrayed me, and I slaughtered them. Asmodeus is the only one who robs me, and all I have to rob. I have transformed the Crimson Hand from a mockery to a reality, and it is time to destroy the last insult. It is time to remove you, great poison. I would kill you for insulting Asmodeus. I would sacrifice your immortal life to him, and let him roost upon this world and sit by his side for all eternity as his beloved daughter.
Yeah, about that, said Magnus. If you had the power of a prince of hell, I would have noticed.
If any warlock alive had the power of a prince of hell, they would already rule this world, Shinyan told him impatiently. All warlocks are Asmodeus' children. If they prove themselves worthy, that's what the Crimson Hand taught me.
So you've adopted Asmodeus? Magnus said. Or he's adopted you? He looked at her. He was not thrilled about being in prison. He was even less thrilled by the prospect of his inglorious destiny. But he still couldn't hate her. He still understood why she was the way she was, the forces that had shaped her, and where the shadow of his own hands fell across her past.
Don't look at me like that. I don't want your pity.
Shinyan stepped forward and closed her hands about his throat. Magnus gagged and choked. Warlocks were immortal, but not invulnerable. He would die if deprived of oxygen.
You were never worthy, she whispered, as he strained for breath. My people should never have followed you. My father should never have honored you. Your place belongs to me.
After a moment, Shinyan must have realized that she was choking the life out of her so-called father's sacrifice. She let him go. Magnus sagged back in his chains, gasping as air rushed into his lungs.
Why? He choked. All this time you were helping us. You were just leading us into this trap. Why didn't you just grab me in Paris, or on the train, or at any other opportunity you had? Why go through this charade?
Alric. Shinyan said his name as if it was poison. Every time I was close to seizing you, he got in the way. I had you cornered in the Paris Tarot Market until he arrived at the alley. We actually had you in our grasp on the train until he began cutting down all my demons like a chaff. Alric took out the pack of Rom demons and most of the Ravenous Swarm. All that was left was my maimed brood mother. I couldn't trust her to finish the job. And I couldn't risk losing track of you. I decided I had to stay as close to you as possible.
Shinyan's laugh was different from any laugh Magnus had heard from her before. It was cruel, hollow, and bitter.
I've become very skilled at pretending over the centuries in the service of my father. My faith is a gift given to me, that I might serve Asmodeus better. People cannot see what I truly feel. They project onto a mask what they wish for, and never think that I am real beneath the mask. I give them what they want to see and tell them what they want to hear. But that Shadow Hunter didn't want anything from me. And the only thing that worked on you was making you feel sorry for me. I hated doing that so much. I hated you so much, and I still couldn't stop him watching you, protecting you, always at the ready. I realized that the only way I could take you down was if I got you away from Alexander Wrightwood first.
Magnus thought of his regret earlier that day that Alec had felt driven to go to the Rome Institute. Now he was only grateful. Alec would be safe there, and Magnus could face anything if Alec was safe. Xinyan snapped her fingers, and several men entered Magnus's cell. They were all dressed in white with severe faces.
"Take him to the pit, Bernard," said Xinyan.
"Don't take me to the pit, Bernard," suggested Magnus. "I hate the word pit. It sounds ominous. And grubby.
Also, hello, evil cult member Bernard." Evil cult member Bernard gave Magnus a peeved look. He was stick-thin, with dark hair slicked back in a way that accentuated his pointy chin and tuft of a beard and an air of wannabe authority. He snapped the iron manacles off Magnus's hands with unnecessary force. Magnus slid down to the ground with the chains no longer supporting him. Even Bernard posed a significant threat to Magnus right now. He forced himself to stand upright, but it was all he could do. He felt sick and dizzy and utterly bereft of magic. Xinyan had taken no chances with her poison. She clearly wanted Magnus to have no chance in the pit.
"One last thing," said Xinyan, and she sounded like she was smiling.
She stepped close to Magnus.
"I read you to a place where you could not receive calls. I rendered your phone unusable. And I contacted Alec myself on your behalf."
She smiled.
"I set a trap for each of you. Alec Wrightwood should be dead shortly."
Magnus could base anything if Alec was safe. It was a dark explosion in Magnus's mind, a howling scream of agony and rage, a rage that he rarely, if ever, allowed himself to feel, a rage that came from his father. He lunged for Xinyan. Bernard and the other cult members grabbed his arms, holding him back as he struggled. Blue sparks, faint and pale, appeared at his fingertips. Xinyan patted Magnus's face, the gesture almost hard enough to be a slap.
"I do hope you said a proper farewell to your child of the angel, Magnus Bane," she murmured. "I can't imagine you two are going to the same afterlife."
Chapter 23. Helen Blackthorne's Blood. The pillars of fire climbed tall, each rising above the tree line. The heat was intensifying, clawing at Alec's skin as though it could tear his runes away. He considered his dwindling options. The pillars were spaced about 50 feet apart in a rough circle. If they were quick, they could charge between two and escape. But just as Alec moved to dive through an opening, the pillars on either side bent to block him, reshaping themselves in an instant, and then returning to their original height when he backed off. Alec had seen a shadow hunter jump flames this high once before, but he was not Jace, and he couldn't do it.
"Oh, by the angel," said Helen.
Alec assumed she was just bemoaning their situation, but when he glanced at her, he saw her eyes were closed. Her hair streamed in her face, a silver mirror that almost reflected the firelight. She said,
"I'm so sorry. This is all my fault."
"How could this possibly be your fault?" Aline asked.
"Mori Shu sent me a message asking for protection because he was being hunted by the leader of the Crimson Hand," said Helen in a rush. "He came to Paris to find me. He picked me, specifically, because my mother was a fairy. He thought I would be more worried about the fairy deaths and more sympathetic to downworlders. I should have taken Mori Shu into protective custody. I should have told the Paris Institute everything. But instead I tried to deal with it on my own. I wanted to find the leader of the Crimson Hand and prove I was a great shadow hunter, and nothing like a downworlder at all."
Aline pressed a hand to her mouth as she watched Helen. There were tears sliding down Helen's face under her long, curling eyelashes. Alec kept his eyes moving, checking on the pillars of flame, which seemed content to simply trap them here until probably something worse showed up.
"But from the start I kept messing up," Helen went on. "I was meant to meet with Mori in Paris, but instead the Crimson Hand caught up with him and sent demons to kill us. Mori Shu fled. Leon was following me around, and we both would have been killed by the demons if Alec hadn't intervened. I still didn't ask anybody for help. Maybe Morishu would still be alive if I had. I didn't go to the head of the Paris Institute or the head of the Rome Institute once Morishu pointed me there. Now we're caught in a trap, waiting to die, all because I didn't want to tell anybody that a warlock had chosen me.